Todos, gracias por estar aquí.
¿Se oye bien?
Para mí es un placer presentar esta noche a Michael Ondaatje, un autor al que admiro terriblemente y respeto. Y voy a comenzar por una presentación muy general, muy rápida, en inglés, de manera que si ustedes tienen sus audífonos, es el momento de usarlos. Michael Ondaatje is a novelist, poet, a film buff, a magazine editor, many other things. I will try to cover all of those aspects of his very rich creative life in the course of this conversation. Michael, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
There's a character in your last novel, Divisadero, a writer, Lucien Segura, French writer at that, who at some point in the novel says that he loves to see people perform a trade. He loves to see them do what they're good at. But he walks away every time they begin to discuss what they're doing. And he says, as if one should ask a grave digger whether he prefers to dig by day or night, or what kind of shovel he uses. So since I'm going to ask you all sorts of shovel-type question, I would like to know if you share his opinion.
I use a grade A shovel all the time. And it, of course, as a writer, and I'm curious about what kind of shovel people use, what kind of pen, what kind of notebooks people use. So I think that's a natural way to begin.
Do you write by day or night?
Day. And I write in longhand. So I mean, I tend to write most of my books and about three or four drafts in longhand before, in notebooks, before I gradually get it onto a computer. And then I go back and, you know, work on... I have to work on an actual physical... I can't work on a computer. I can't edit on a computer, I think. And editing is a very important part of my... the process of writing for me, and I can do it on a computer because you can only see one third of the page or half a page, and you want to have a sense of the pages before, etc.
Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that you began writing poetry instead of prose writing?
Yes, I think. Well, I think first of all, I begin a poem. I used to begin a poem without knowing where the poem was going to go, so there was a sense of discovery in the process of writing the poem. And even if I thought the poem was going to be about A, it turned out to be about F. And then once I started to edit the poem, it altered into something else, completely different. So I think that idea of being able to scratch and, you know, remove things and add things between the lines, etc., that's always been a very central part of writing for me. I mean, I think the act of editing is as important as the actual discovery of what the story is, in a way.
Is this why it takes you so long between novels? There are at least 5 years between two of your novels, between The English Patient and Anil's Ghost, for instance. There were 8 years. Does this have to do with that?
Well, first of all, the process of writing is the part I like most about being a writer. The part where you are selling your book with numerous, you know, tours later on is a bit hellish for me. So, I mean, I try and extend the writing of the novel as long as I can. But also, I am an obsessive rewriter. I mean, because the first draft is this discovery of what the story is. Ornette Coleman has this line where he says... you begin with the territory, and then you have the adventure. So, you know, that process of discovering where the story will lead you can lead into all kinds of wrong corners and roads. So the act of editing, for me, is what saves the book. And, you know, and the rewriting, the removal of things that say too much, the adding of little delicacies, the setting up of the hook, all those things are very important.
So you don't know...
Right. Yep.
You don't know this. Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah. So you don't know the story when you begin, right?
No, I don't.
So what do you begin with?
Hearing Ian, it's quite similar. I don't really have a kind of... I have to begin with that territory. I usually know the place and the time. And the hint of some enigmatic character, perhaps, who I don't really know. And the one with the English patient, it was a man in a bed, obviously a patient, talking to a woman, or was a nurse, but I didn't know who she was, I didn't know who he was. And as the scene was built, I then started writing about somebody else, about a thief who was trying to steal back a photograph of him. And so how were these two stories connected? So, I mean, gradually the thief story and the patient story kind of got bigger and bigger until they kind of met. And so that they became part of a larger mural. So that was all I knew at the beginning. I didn't know the names, I didn't know the background, I didn't know how he had become a patient. I didn't know that he'd been burned in a plane crash. But that is the discovery, the kind of unearthing or the kind of archaeology that takes place when you're writing.
What relationship does research have in the whole thing? Because I will ask you later about the relationship between your work and what we could call historical facts. Many of your novels deal with historical people, Count Almasi in The English Patient, Buddy Bolden in Coming Through Slaughter, even Billy the Kid. How do you do research? What kind of research gets into the project? How do you develop that? How do you work at the unearthing of facts along with the creation of the fiction?
Well, the historical situation also is very helpful to me because I have so little to go on at the beginning. That also kind of grounds me. You know, if it is Italy in 1944 or Suez in 1936 or something like that, I have that location. And with The English Patient, once I started to write about this person, I then, through a friend, was told about this man who was an archaeologist and had worked in the desert between the wars, and then he had been involved with spying and taken a spy to Cairo. And I read a book called The Cat and the Mouse, which was about the spy, but I was much more interested in the man who took him across the desert, and that turned out to be Almasi. So then I went to the Royal Geographical Society and I tried to find out anything I could about him. But so meanwhile, I was writing the novel. I had the guy in the bed and he was talking away, and you know, I had a past. And so that was just a sort of fragment of information about this man. And I've tended to kind of, if I'm writing about a historical character, I tend to kind of prefer people that are not that well known. That, you know, even if you spend a year of research, you only have about half a page of facts. And, you know, with the book on Buddy Bolden, Coming Through Slaughter, which is about a jazz musician, there really was only half a page of facts. And with Almasi, the same thing occurred. And that actually delights me, because it gives me the freedom to improvise as well as, you know, try and do research. And I find that if I find a great story that exists in the research, if it's a well-made story already, I cannot use it. When I was working on the bomb disposal stuff in The English Patient, I'd read quite a bit about that. And there was one wonderful story about the top bomb disposal man who would kind of, you know, go down to the sewers and, you know, defuse the bomb whistling, you know. And at one point he went down to this place and came back screaming. And they said, "Well, what's wrong?" And he said, "There's a rat down there." And so they got a sniper. The guy went down, shot the rat, and then he went down very happily and defused the bomb. And I was dying to use the story, but it was already complete. You know, I couldn't add to it. You know, if someone had talked about a guy who's a bomb disposal guy who hated rats, that was enough. You know, so when you pick up stories, it's the kind of half-finished ones that are the useful ones, I think.
But we know that Vargas Llosa traveled to Brazil when he was writing The War, The End of the World, and he has traveled to Congo and the Peruvian jungle to write the novel he's working on. So unrelated to the research for historical facts, do you do that kind of things? I mean, your prose is very, very sensuous, very precise on the physical details of the world. Do you visit these places, the bridge construction for In the Skin of a Lion, the desert and the English Patient?
I had been to the desert in Tunisia about 10 years earlier, and I didn't go back. And then my first long book, The Collected Works of Billy the Kid, which takes place in New Mexico and Mexico, at that point I couldn't afford to go there, so I had to kind of invent a mental landscape along with a lot of maps. And so, I mean, I got used to that very early on. It wasn't always necessary to go there. I did go to New Orleans for coming through Stoller, but not for that long. You know, there's a danger of having too much research. You know, I think then you start kind of worrying about the exact length of the raincoat and stuff like that. And while it's useful, you then get into a kind of time capsule, especially if you're writing about a historical time that's not your own. And you want also to have, if it's a sort of a historical novel, you want to also, it has to be about your own time as much as that earlier time. You know, the way something like Red Badge of Courage is about, is a contemporary novel, not just about the Civil War.
Would you mind if I ask you a couple of questions about your origins? You were born in Colombo, in Sri Lanka, but you only spent the first 11 years of your life there. Then you immigrated to England, and then finally to Canada. And I remember there's this character in your family memoir, Running in the Family. I think it's one of your uncles who is asked by this judge, what is your nationality? And he says, God only knows, Your Excellency. How would you answer that question?
I have to answer the same way, I think. You know, my family originally, I think, came to Sri Lanka from India, and then they kind of married anyone who was passing through, so it's a complete mixed salad of genealogy. And, you know, the name was probably, if you, phonetically, a very different spelling, but then the kind of business side of the family at a certain time made the name Ondaatje look like a Dutch name for business, because the Dutch had invaded, you know, Ceylon at the time. And in fact, a few years ago, I found a town called Ondaatje, which was spelled O-N-D-A-C-H-C-H-I, which is actually a beautiful spelling, a double C-H I love. But anyway, they'd become a fake Dutch name by that point.
Does the name have a meaning?
It originally meant those who made metal objects for temples, which is also pretty good.
Very good.
Yep.
How much do those 11 years in Sri Lanka weigh on your imaginary life? How have they become a part of your creative life later? Mm-hmm. Do they matter that much?
Are they what?
Do they matter that much?
They've mattered a lot. I mean, it didn't matter for a long time, because when I left Sri Lanka, I came to England, and I was thrown into a school in England. I was so bewildered that I think I had to forget my past. And I think this happens to a lot of people who come to a new country. You can either keep looking back, or you have to kind of land on your feet. And so I was at the school where I was just having to learn how to tie a tie and wear socks, you know, which I'd never done in my life before. And so I didn't really kind of deal with the past until quite a while later on. And that was when I wrote some poems about my family in Sri Lanka, and then I wrote a book called Running the Family, which was about, I went back after about 30 years and talked to all my uncles and aunts and whatever relatives I had there. And I discovered that, you know, there was no literature about this group of people. You know, so it was, I was dependent on an oral tradition. So the great stories were told at the dinner table, you know, and if I went back and asked someone about a story, to check the authenticity, the person immediately, you know, made the story even more dramatic so I would not be bored. So someone this time jumped 20 feet as opposed to 10 feet. And so, you know, I realized I was hearing a pack of lies. And I decided, okay, then the book is about a pack of lies. You know, so that the past and running the family, all those stories about my father's drunkenness and grandmother's bad behavior and a drowning and all this stuff are kind of stories I sort of was told. And then I began to invent a few stories myself. So it's not a very authentic, factual book.
That's what you mean at the end of the book in the author's note when you say that in Sri Lanka, a well-told lie is better than...
Is worth a thousand facts.
Worth a thousand facts,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. So I'm not too reliable as a historian. So.
What were your beginnings as a reader? We all know in the post-colonial world, somebody with your background has a very tense, or usually has a tense relationship with the English language. Was that your case? How do you remember those first years as a reader of English literature?
Well, I mean, I knew English and I knew some Sinhala at the time before I left, but I didn't really read that much. I mean, again, it was listening to stories, and it wasn't until I came to England and went to school in England that I started to read. But I'd never thought about being a writer. It wasn't until I went to Canada when I was about 18 or 19 that I began to write, and I would never have dreamed of writing, earlier on. You know, I read a lot. In my teens, I read many novels, and my image of writers was on the back of the Penguin books. They had these very, 15-line biographies of writers, and I'd study them, but as a kind of strange cult, rather than what I wanted to be. And I remember Nigel Balchin, who wrote The Small Back Room. In the back of it, it said he wrote his first novel during his honeymoon, which I thought that's a rather dangerous act. But and how many times was he married? I wonder. You know. So I never dreamed of being a writer until I came to Canada, and then I started to write poetry, and it was really. Poetry was saving my life at that time. I was in a new country. I was 18 years old, and I was trying to make some sense of myself, you know. So the novels came much later.
Who were you reading? Was there a particular writer that, gave you the impulse to imitate?
No, I read a lot of trashy paperbacks, and along with Evelyn Waugh and others. So it was a kind of mixture, and I didn't read any poetry. And it really was the poetry at university that I suddenly kind of connected with. You know, it was Robert Browning and very early Ted Hughes and Tom Gunn and people like that. That kind of, and then through that into Yeats, and through that into William Carlos Williams and others. Wallace Stevens. So it was really the poets that really got me wanting to be a writer.
What about Billy the Kid? Critics usually throw the book into that lot along with your first books of poetry. But it's not exactly a collection of poems, obviously. How do you conceive the book? Is there conscious reflection about genre, mixing and bending, or do you just go along with what the idea suggests?
No, there was no conscious plan for the book and no conscious awareness of what the genre was. It really began as a series of poems, and for about a year and a half I was writing these poems from the voice of Billy the Kid. And after about a year and a half, I suddenly had the urge to kind of jump on a horse and ride. This is a Western after all. And so I started to write prose for the first time. And the prose just kind of poured out of me. You know, I was obviously waiting to be released in some way. And so the book is half poetry and half prose. And I just loved the writing of the prose in that book. And then I decided, I looked for interviews with Billy the Kid. There were no interviews, so I invented an interview. And then I invented songs, and half the photographs in the book are forgeries of friends of mine pretending to be, pioneers. So I had no idea what the genre was I had invented at that point. And I think that's true of all my books, I think, in some way. I've never gone into a book feeling sure what the final format will be. You know, it's something to do that'll occur later on in the process of where the story ends or, you know, how you change it and alter it in the editing.
Are poetry and prose different tools you use to get different places? Do you have an idea of what type of, what genre does an idea need? Or how was the transit from that time of poetry to Coming Through Slaughter, which you published in 1976? So you were writing for 10 years already or more.
Well, I think the thing about poetry is it's a very, very intimate whisper, almost. You know, it's you're writing it for yourself or for someone very close to you. And when I was writing a novel for the first time, it was much more of a theatrical thing. It was like if you have to be aware that where the stage is lit. You know, someone can't start talking over there if he's in the dark. So you have to light it. And that sounds a bit more technical than what I'm thinking about, but when doing the editing, I'm conscious of those things. But I think what I wanted to take with me from poetry into fiction was that intimacy. That intimacy so someone can just speak and you're getting the mind at work. You know, I'm more interested in writing about characters from the inside than from outside, looking at them and describing what their hair looks like and what dress they're wearing. You know, I'd rather be inside the character of Hannah or Catherine. You know, so I don't really even know what those characters look like. I do know how they feel.
So Coming Through Slaughter, this is your first novel, is written in a way that suggests its subject, which is a jazz musician. And it's written in what I would imprecisely describe as a jazzy way. How would you describe the type of structures and writing you used to write that book?
Well, again, it seemed to be the only way I could write that book. You know, I didn't want to have photographs and poems as I had in Billy the Kid. I just wanted to, you know, write it point blank about this person, either from his point of view or from the point of view of a friend. And it was only much later on that I realized, obviously, this isn't a jazz improvisation on, you know, half a page of facts about Buddy Bolden. And, you know, what happened after about a year, you began to think like this person. I mean, sound became very, very important to me. You know, I'd be on a train in the dining car, I'd be very conscious of the forks, you know, clinking against the glass or something like that. So I think when you're writing a novel, it takes a while for you to kind of suddenly start listening and feeling and thinking like the character you've invented. And that's when the book actually takes off. In English Patient, I was halfway through the book before the patient started talking, you know, and talking about, you know, colonialism and, you know, history and other, and about things I hadn't really known I knew even, you know. So it's gradually, you have to get yourself into a position where the characters take on a life, but, you know, you are guiding it in a way. So you're waiting for that moment, and not just that sometimes, but you're waiting for something else. And in The English Patient, it was the character of Kip who turned up halfway through the book, and I had not expected him to turn up at all. And the character of Garmini in Anil's Ghost was also a surprise. So I'm always waiting for the uninvited guest, you know, to turn up and, in fact, become the angel of the story in some way.
So The English Patient, I think it's safe to say that changed your life. I mean, you went from being a wonderful writer to being a wonderful famous writer. Also through the adaptation by Anthony Minghella of the film. How close did you work with him? Because we all know that you're a very big film fan. Later I would like to discuss your film book, your book on editing with Walter Murch. But first this, how close did you work with Anthony Minghella?
Well, I'd made before that a couple of documentaries, one on a poet and one on a theater company in Canada. And so I knew film, the craft of film pretty well, and especially the art of editing, you know, which editing a documentary is what makes a documentary, you know. It's chaos before you start editing it. So I didn't think they could make a film out of this. I thought the only scenes that could work as a film would be the scenes where Kip is in training in England to become a bomb disposal guy. Because I'd seen lots of movies like that. And of course, that was one thing they dropped right away. Mm-hmm. So what happened with Anthony Minghella and Saul Zantz, who was a producer, I mean, we met a lot beforehand, and then every time Anthony had a draft of the script, the three of us would meet and, you know, I mean, literally go over it like a poem, I mean, word by word. And that was actually a great learning process for me, as much as for, I guess, the other two. I think they were surprised that I was willing to see changes made. You know, I think they thought I'd be very kind of, I think they wanted me there only for the first time, but we got on so well that I was there for three or four drafts. And I remember the interesting thing they did was after the fourth, no one else had seen these drafts until the fourth draft, and then Saul Zantz sent it out to whoever has to see these things, and he said, first draft. So, my God, if this is the first draft, we can go from here, you know. So, but it was a really wonderful, because Anthony actually is very much a writer. He became known as a director mostly, but he was a playwright. You know, he was very interested in short stories and novels. So it was very close.
One of the most celebrated scenes from the film, and this is an anecdote I love, is the one in which Juliette Binoche is taken in this sort of platform to see the frescoes, was it?
Yeah.
How did that differ from the actual novel?
Well, in the novel, it's an old man, you know, who's kind of hoisted up by Kip so he can see the murals in Arezzo. And obviously, Minghella changed it from an old man to Juliette Binoche being hoisted up and, you know, kind of made a very different kind of scene. And I kind of jokingly said, no, we need an old man. But the funny thing that happened was that I was doing a reading somewhere in the States, and there was a man in the audience who was an art historian, and he said, you know, the mural you describe about so-and-so when he is way up high is only about 1 foot off the floor. And I said, oh, my God, I totally, you know, mixed up my murals. But when they made the film, of course, they had a kind of recreated this place, and they had the recreated mural way up high. And I kept thinking, that art historian is going to go mad because he thinks he was wrong and I was right. But anyway.
So you published in 2000, I think, the book about Walter Murch, mm-hmm, and film editing.
A bit later than that, wasn't it?
2002?
I don't know. Yeah, about that.
So who is Walter Murch?
Walter Murch is a film editor, American film editor, who had worked on with Coppola and others very, very early on in their careers, and he had edited, did the sound edit on the Godfather films and did the actual edits on later Godfather films. And is a very, very interesting man because he's a very articulate man, unlike a lot of people in the film trade, you know. And I mean, he's happy to talk about physics as much as, you know, acting and editing. And he also wrote a book called In the Blink of an Eye. And we got to know each other pretty well during the editing stage of the film. And I decided after I'd finished Arnold's Ghost, and I guess I was wiped out, and I just wanted to get out of my own brain for a while. And I thought, I'll write a book about Walter Murch. And what he was a book of interviews with him about how he became a sound editor and a film editor. And it was fascinating because, you know, I having done those documentaries, I realized that I loved the art of editing. You know, it's so microscopic that if you cut on the seventh frame as opposed to the 14th frame of a second, it makes a difference in pacing. And Murch had all these kind of wonderful little rules. So, for instance, if the camera is on someone and he tells you the way to get to the station is down here and then turn left, and then you cut to somebody else, that's fine. But if he says that to you and the camera stays on him a bit too long, like another extra second, you begin to believe he's lying. So, I mean, there are all these very, very specific great craft rules about editing film, which, in fact, is really about editing any kind of art. It, you know, it could be about writing, it could be about poetry, it could be about dance. It's the art of kind of fine-tuning something so you've just said only what you really need to say. You know, you can, and that's something I'm very conscious of when I'm editing poetry and I'm also editing a novel. So I love the discussions with him about this, you know, and how sound is used and how, you know, things which are almost subliminal to an audience and how they affect you.
There's a moment in which he discusses a certain scene in The Godfather in which Michael Corleone is alone.
He kills his first man in the restaurant.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you remember what...
Yeah, and what happened was that Coppola said, I don't want any music until the very end. When he drops the gun, then I want opera. And he said, well, what kind of dramatic music do you want then? He said, I don't want music, any kind of music. So Murch, who was doing the sound on the film, said, okay. And the scene begins with a very quiet pop as a cork comes out of a wine bottle. And then you have this scene where Michael's terrified about doing this. He goes to the bathroom, and he comes back, and he gets the gun, and then shoots him. And that takes about, feels like 10 minutes, probably about 2 minutes. And what Murch did was had the sound of an L train, which was outside the restaurant, you know, beginning very quietly and getting louder and louder and louder. And it's a completely unreal sound because by the end, that train should be in the restaurant. It's so loud. And then he shoots him, the sound disappears, he walks out the door, opera. And this is the thing about writing about or discussing editing in film is we all know those scenes, you know, so we can put that scene in our head or go and watch the video or something like that. But, you know, if you say about that great editing, piece of editing of paragraphs by Flaubert and Madame Bovary, the fourth chapter, you're not quite sure what exactly happened there. We can go back and read it. And I think what I found that was useful about the book, The Conversations, was that you could actually learn about the craft, which in fact applies to all crafts of art, I think.
There are wonderful anecdotes also about Apocalypse Now, which is one of my favorite.
Who?
Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite films. Also some issues about its music. Do you remember that?
I think Coppola got these guys to drum their way through the whole movie, and then they used some of that for the film as well. Yeah.
What exact things changed in your own writing through the conversations with Walter Murch? Because I think they're very detailed, and your involvement with him was, you know, long enough that you could learn things and apply them to your own trade.
Well, strangely, I think I reacted against him. I mean, I believed everything he said, and I think all those rules and principles are true. And at the same time, you don't want to kind of carry those rules or somebody else's rules or even the rules you worked with or the last book into the next book. I mean, you don't want to bring baggage to the new book. So I'm sure if Murch read Divisadero, he'd raise his eyebrows. You know, you can't do this. You can't stop and start the novel again in a different way. I mean, there's something that he talks about in one of the books where all the main characters in the book have got to be there in the first two or three scenes. So they can disappear, but when they come back, we know who they are. And that doesn't happen in novels. The thing is that a novel, what works in a novel and what works in a film is a completely different thing. At the end of The English Patient, you have Hiroshima occurring and the influence of that on Kip. When they shot the movie, they shot the scene of the response to Kip, of Kip to Hiroshima, and it seemed like it belonged to another film. You know, suddenly we were discussing something 4,000 miles away. And film is, in some ways, very limited in location. You can't jump. It looked like somebody else put a new reel in suddenly, you know, unless you're Rene. We're talking about American movies. We're not talking about other movies, but that certainly is true. And you know, lots of interesting rules that things you can do in film and you cannot do in novels and vice versa.
But you haven't written a screenplay yet.
Pardon?
You haven't written a screenplay yet. Is that something that interests
no,
you?
No, I have no interest in writing screenplays. I would probably have to kill myself first. You know, I think I did write a screenplay I wrote one of a friend's book many, many years ago, but just to try it out. But it is a kind of tough thing. It's writing a sonnet, you know, with 85 different versions of the same sonnet, in a way.
But you have adapted some of your own work to other disciplines, in theater and dance.
Coming Through Story and the collective works of Billy the Kid for the stage. But I kind of feel slightly fakey about it. You know, I mean, they've worked, but I know that they're not plays. And, you know, so I've never really tried. I don't think I could adapt my own work for film myself. I mean, I think people do that and can do that, but I would find that difficult to dismantle the book and then, which you have to do, I think, to do a film.
Let's go back to the novels. After The English Patient came Annual's Ghost. This is your first novel set in Sri Lanka, in your birthplace. Mm-hmm. What made you go back there? Did you go looking for a novel? Was that did you build a novel with the same material you compiled when writing Running in the Family? How did that work?
A lot had changed since Running the Family, and you know there had been this pretty horrific political climate in Sri Lanka. In the years between the two books. And when I finished English Patient, actually what I wanted to do most of all was write poetry again. And I hadn't written poetry for a couple of books. So I went back to Sri Lanka and I was writing, I wrote a book called Handwriting, which is about a lot about Sri Lanka and discussion, some of the hints of the politics in there, but it was really about going back and unearthing the past, my own past and so forth. And gradually, while I was writing that book, I realized I wanted to write a novel about what was happening in Sri Lanka or what had happened in the previous 8 or 9 years. And I didn't know how to write it because, you know, the trouble with a place like Sri Lanka is that everyone has a different version of what really happened. And it wasn't until I decided to have like two narrators, essentially, or two central characters. Anil, who leaves Sri Lanka, becomes educated in the West and comes back to Sri Lanka, and Sarath, who is an archaeologist who lives there, and they're both teamed up to investigate a forensic case. And that allowed me an argument, you know, between the two of them, a constant argument all the way through the book while we discovered what the story is. And it was the first book of mine that I really felt I could understand the Alice Munro, the William Faulkner, about having your own place that you could write about and write the hell out of, you know. The comfort of going back to your home turf. And I've never really had that, you know, because the books have been all over the place until then. So there, I think in the character of Anil, who's I know it's a male name, but it's a woman in the book, I was able to kind of have doubled my own self by having a female character in some way being the central character of the book. And also that way, it wasn't about me. It was, you know, it was an invented character who is part of this political investigation.
So is the novel in a way a criticism or a riposte to those European novels about people who go to this exotic country and then go back to the safety of their homes to tell the story?
It partially became that, you know. I mean, I had an idea for the ending. About halfway through, I knew what the ending was going to be, and it was going to end with Anil in New Mexico at the lightning fields. And then suddenly there's a scene about two-thirds of the way through where she's with her two brothers, Sarath and Gamini, and I realized, no, the book doesn't end with her leaving the country. The book ends after she's left the country and what happens to these two people. And so the book veered off into that their story, you know. And as a result of that, it became a part, there's a line about, you know, people go off there and, you know, have an adventure in a other country and then leave and write the story. But I just wanted to keep it, I want the after effects, the shock effects, the result of all that activity that happens in that book to stay in Sri Lanka.
Divisadero, your last novel, your last published novel, both in Spanish and English. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful book, but I'm tempted to say it's a beautiful couple of books. Mm-hmm. In a way, the first half is completely different from the second half. And I wanted to discuss that structure with you. How did that come about? The first half is about Anna, Coop, and Claire, these people that live together in the mountains. And I've read somewhere that setting was the beginning of the book. Is that right?
That was what?
The setting. The setting was the beginning
of the
book.
That was the setting, yes. And then about halfway through the book, shifts to France and follows the life of a writer named Lucien Segura, a French poet, fictional, who lived at the beginning of the 20th century. And the character of Anna, who is one of the characters in the first part of the book, is writing a book about him. And so we are getting, though it's not said, the second part of the book in a way is her version of this man's life, which has many echoes of what happens to her traumatically earlier on in the novel. So there's that going on. And it was just a different kind of structure. You know, I think, I mean, Vargas Llosa spoke today about form is everything, you know, in a novel. And I think the thing is that, well, which form? You know, there are so many forms. And When I read Faulkner, I thought, okay, I would love to write a novel. I would never have imagined a novelist like Faulkner, because the novels I read up to that point were much more formal in the official way, you know. And the adventure of this kind of typhoon of Faulkner's incidents and so forth excited me a great deal when I began to write. In a way, the book begins with a youthful story, and then it ends with old age. So, I mean, there are many, many other ways of structuring a novel, like not just chronologically. I've never believed in chronology as a realistic way of portraying our own lives. You know, so the story that she tells, and I don't think she even realizes what she's doing in the novel by picking up certain things. You know. The first part of the book is about her father and the trauma that her father creates in her life. And then the second part is about a father, a man who, and dealing with two daughters. So there are lots of constant echoes, but not too obviously, hopefully.
I read somewhere, just again talking about the way you build your books, either you said or somebody said about you that they are written on the principle of collage. What do you think of that?
Oh, I think collage and jazz began the 20th century for me. You know, I mean, that's what's... In terms of the visual arts, collage, it's a great art form. I just love it because, I mean, you put a piece of blue paper that's silky against a rough piece of brown cardboard and you can make something that in the overall pattern is sensational and beautiful, and you're making it out of diverse pieces. And when I structured the poems and prose of Billy the Kid, that I was making a collage. And in many ways, in the Buddy Bolden book, it is a kind of collage of a life. And I think it's very interesting. I mean, I think just that there are different ways of form, using form in a novel, and one of them is a more Asian one, where you kind of you have all the jottings and assemblies and pieces and put them all together, and as a result, the figure emerges that's not just made logically in a book. You know, so collage. I'm someone who's actually, as a writer, probably more influenced by the other arts than by writing. You know, music or... when I was doing In the Skin of a Lion, Diego Rivera's murals were essential to me. You know, I mean, just seeing those great murals where a man is holding up a pencil, and one of the officials is holding up a pencil over there, and then way over there, someone's holding up a wrench in exactly the same hand movement. But there are miles between them in terms of their societies. And that kind of rhyme and echoing, which is partly what happens in poetry, I guess I wanted to use in my fiction as well. So it was, you know, visual arts such as that, or jazz, or other kinds of music became important to me.
I'm now thinking about Anna, who goes to France in a way to look for herself. Yeah. It's more or less the same thing that happens to Hannah, who finds herself in a way in Italy during the war. There are the Macedonian immigrants in The Skin of a Lion. Your books seem to deal a lot with displacement, with people being where they were not originally supposed to be or something like that. Why is that such a big thing for you?
Well, I think I've had a pretty nomadic life, and I think that interests me. At certain times in a life, you want to change your life, you know, and it can be caused by some traumatic event, or it could be caused by politics, or it could be a desire to escape. And I think all of these things are very active. You know, I think if you go to a room in dinner in Toronto, about 80% of the people there were not born in Toronto, you know, so I think that's a sign of our time, certainly. But I think in the novels, I think that is that next step, you know, as a writer, rather than move your home, you move the location of your novels, which is one way of doing it, I suppose.
Do you think novels, this is my last question before giving the floor to the public, do you think novels give us something that no other narrative genre does? Do you think there's a reason for novels surviving in our world? Do you think they are indispensable for us as readers, in the same way it seems it is for us as writers?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, I would much, you know, if the novel ended, I wouldn't be worried so much about me not writing. I'd be worried about not having to read anything. You know, I think that's the main pleasure in life. One of the great literary pleasures is reading. You know, I mean, the act of making a book is a great pleasure in making something, whether it's a table or a lantern or a book. But it's having those books come to you and surprising you with, you know, incredible worlds you step into, I suppose. That's wonderful.
Actually, that was my next to last question. Because I just remembered, I wanted to know also about your job as a magazine editor. You have this wonderful magazine called Brick with your wife, yeah. Lynn Spaulding. How is that experience? Why are you there? What does that give to you?
Well, if I take 5 years or 6 years to write a book, you know, the magazine comes out twice a year, so you feel you're doing something else as well. You know, it's like you're making. I mean, I was saying last night to a friend that, you know, the pleasure of doing the magazine for me was paste up. You know, it's where you put together the pictures and the size of the pictures and this article for. It's again, it's collage, and you're just making an object again, and having articles that are as diverse as possible, like from all over the world, preferably. And you suddenly make a kind of unit out of all that. So that's why I do the magazine.
Can you tell us about your most recent discovery, a big writer you've discovered?
I was saying that this writer named John Ely, E-H-L-E, who's an American writer from North Carolina, who's about 85 years old now, who's I've sort of just discovered in the last year, and he's barely published in America and almost totally unknown. And I think he's an amazing, a great American writer, novelist. All the books set in North Carolina. And when you discover something like this, you realize that, you know, what does he think with all this crap out there? You know, that's not half as good as he is. You know, and he's a total unknown man who should be celebrated, you know, by being brought up by vintage or something like that.
Makarandaji, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can we just, yeah. Any questions from the public? There's, one over here in the first row. Por favor. Sí.
Sí, usted dijo al principio que la parte que le parece una pesadilla es la de la promoción del libro una vez que ya está realizado. Yo quisiera saber hasta qué punto pues sí es cierto eso y por qué lo es, y si usted en un momento dado le gustaría decirle a las empresas, yo solamente voy a hacer teleconferencias para hablar de mi libro.
Well, of course, it's not a nightmare. You know, I'm exaggerating here. But I mean, the point is that the real pleasure of being a writer is when you're inventing and shaping something and rewriting and reconsidering something. And that's a very intimate and freeing thing. And once the book is out, and that's, you know, you become something else in a way. I'm not talking about festivals like this, by the way. I'm talking about, you know, when you're sent on the road for like 3 weeks or something like that. And you can say no. And actually, I have said I don't do as much as some other writers do. But because the gift for the film, for me, was that it kind of advertised my books without me having to turn up and be on talk shows at 7 a.m. But the telly thing, I'm not sure about. Perhaps, you know, who knows what the future will bring.
Over here.
Hi, I was just curious, is there any particular reason why you carried Hannah and Caravaggio from the Skins line to the English Patients?
Is there any reason I took them from one book into the other? I sort of missed them. When I finished In the Skin of a Lion, it was in a way my first novel where all the characters were fictional. You know, they were fully invented by me. Up to that point, Buddy Bolden had been a historical character. My father and mother in Running the Family were sort of historical characters, and Billy the Kid was. So I hadn't realized that how intimate they had become for me, how close they became to me. Like, you know, and I was, whereas I didn't miss the characters in the earlier books, I was conscious as the book came to an end. That I was, you know, this was goodbye. And I had no idea that they would turn up again. So when I began The English Patient again, I was about 40 pages into it, and the nurse with the patient beside the patient had no name. And I thought, well, it could be her, and then the thief could be Caravaggio. And I kept going, but I still didn't name them for quite a while, because I don't like books where characters get repeated, because they often, you know, if the reader knows who they are, then they don't. There's not much drama in the actual writing of the characters because we know who they are. But so much had happened because of the war to those characters that they had altered completely. So I kept them, and I was glad I did. And I remember I was doing a thing with a writer once, and she said, well, obviously there's going to be a third volume. You know, they're going to turn up again. And I said, no, they're not. She said, I'm sure they will. I said, no, they're not. And, you know, I really do think that if you create two points of the triangle, you can almost guess what the third point will be. You know, if you read when writers write quartets or trilogies, often the third book doesn't kind of becomes a bit pointless. You know, if you've read Lawrence Durrell's Clear, probably one of the worst books possible.
Could you say something about the relationship between the author and the translator?
Sorry, I couldn't hear that.
The relationship between the author and the translator.
You know, it's pretty distant, unfortunately. I don't really know most of my translators. So I can't really say what that is. I think we are so lucky to live in an age when we have translations. You know, that, you know, the fact that I can read Calvino or whoever the writer is in my own time, in his own time, is a huge gift. So I love translators in that sense. But I just haven't had that kind of contact with translators very much. I do know one story about a writer who was kidnapped by his translator and driven across Holland. The guy's marriage, the translator's wife had just broken up, and he went AWOL with the writer, but not too many stories like that, I'm afraid.
Any more questions? No? Michael Ondaatje, thank you very much.